right now, that wasn't good enough for Colin. It was time, he thought, for someone to find out just what Lester was up to these days. After he dropped Maria off at work, Colin popped in his earbuds, put on some music, and perched himself in front of the computer at his desk. Lester Manning. Proof or not, having a name helped to focus his thoughts, and he wanted to find out as much as he could about the man. The only problem was that without easy access to government databases or official records, there wasn't much he could do. There were no listings in the white pages for anyone named Lester Manning in North Carolina, nor could he find a cell phone number. There were two Lester Mannings on Facebook. One was listed as living in Aurora, Colorado, and the other in Madison, Wisconsin. The first a teenager, the second a man in his 40s. Instagram, Twitter, and Snapchat turned up nothing, nor did a general Google search using the name and the city of Charlotte in various permutations. There were a few sites that held out the promise of more information, phone number, most recent address, and the like, for a fee, and after debating, he typed in his credit card number and gave it a whirl. Thankfully, an address popped up in Charlotte. There was a little more on Avery Manning, including a phone number in Charlotte listing an Avery Manning MD, along with the same address he'd found for Lester. Father and son living together? Or outdated information? There were also a few short articles on the father. The most recent one confirmed Maria's recollection that Manning had had his license suspended for 18 months, apparently for improper care of a number of patients. The most prominent case involved a young man who'd committed suicide. According to the article, Manning failed to properly diagnose the patient's attention deficit disorder and monitor his use of Adderall. Other patients claimed that they simply got worse under his care. If the date of the suspension was accurate, then Avery Manning still wasn't able to practice. Interesting. There was a photograph, too. A man in his mid-50s with thin blonde hair and light blue eyes, staring out of an angular, almost bony face. To Colin, he could have passed for a washed-out gravedigger. Colin couldn't imagine sitting across from the guy for an hour, spilling his guts and hoping for empathy. Another article mentioned Manning's work with prison inmates. The article quoted Manning as saying that many prisoners were sociopaths and beyond practical rehabilitation. Humane incarceration, he said, was the most pragmatic solution to criminal pathology. Other than commenting that Manning considered himself an expert on criminal behavior, Maria hadn't mentioned his work in prisons, and he wondered whether she had even known about it. A little more research eventually brought up the obituary for Eleanor Manning, which said nothing about suicide, but that wasn't surprising. Most people didn't want that fact made public. It also noted that she'd been a mother of three and was survived by her husband and son. Cassie he'd heard about. But there was another sibling? He reviewed half a dozen articles on Avery Manning before finding the answer. In an interview on the subject of depression, Avery noted that his wife had battled depression ever since their son, Alexander Charles Manning, had died in an automobile accident when he was six. Alex, Cassie, Eleanor. So much tragedy for one family. And Lester blamed Maria for one, maybe even two of the deaths. Enough to make Lester torment and terrify her? Yes. The original notes made that plain, as did the pattern. Chronologically or not, Maria was experiencing the same fears that Cassie had. And like Maria, Colin knew how the rest of Cassie's story unfolded. After he got out of prison, Laws met Cassie face to face. Cassie filed a restraining order. The police couldn't find Laws. In the end, Cassie was abducted and murdered. Was that part of Lester's plan as well? It was a massive jump to go from what had happened to Maria so far to the final step. Tormenting was one thing. Murder was another. And he didn't know enough about Lester to try to guess what he might do. That didn't mean, however, that Maria should take any chances. He spent another hour without learning anything more. So much for the easy part. Information that anyone could find, and he wondered about his next step. What did he know about Lester? And what could he assume? Lester had a car, or had use of a car. Not a big assumption, of course, but he wondered what kind of information he could find if he had a license plate number. A few keywords into the search engine turned up a couple of companies with access to all kinds of public records, including car registrations and license plate numbers. It was a bit expensive, but it just might be helpful, and he made a note of the websites in case the need arose. Anything else? Yes, he thought. If he was correct in his assumption, Lester had hidden on the roof across the street when Maria was at work. As for her condo, it would have been easy for Lester to watch her as she came and went, if only because her schedule was predictable. He wouldn't have had to camp out for hours. He could have observed her from the coffee shop across the street or from a parked car. Following her to the restaurant and the nightclub would have been a piece of cake. And? Based on the meeting with Margolis, Colin needed proof that Lester was stalking Maria, and he wondered if he should drive to Charlotte in the hopes of putting a face to a name. Maybe even get a photograph, assuming he could find Lester. But then again, even that might not be enough. The florist had admitted he hadn't gotten a good look at the guy, and Colin doubted the waitress would recognize him. Even Maria hadn't recognized him up close. And finally, there was Copo. The dog's death also fit with the pattern, and the more he thought about it, the more probable it seemed that Lester had killed Copo to hurt Maria and her family. Because he'd been following Maria, he'd know where her parents lived. But more than that, it also meant that he'd watched the family regularly. How else would he have known that Copo had been left behind at the house? Maria had said that Felix brought Copo everywhere, even to the restaurant, that her parents rarely left the dog at home. But how? The Sanchez backyard had a privacy fence, and in a tight-knit suburb, a lurking stranger would have been noticed. How indeed? 20 minutes later, he was driving through the Sanchez neighborhood trying to piece it together. Her parents' house was quiet, apparently no one at home. There were, however, others out and about. A woman jogging on the sidewalk, an elderly man pruning the bushes in his front yard, a man pulling out of his driveway, heading somewhere. Colin turned at the corner, then turned again, heading down the street that ran parallel to the Sanchez's street, backyards bumping up against each other. The neighborhood was bustling, the kind of community where people probably watched out for each other. Lester definitely would have been noticed. Unless... He slowed the car as he approached the houses that backed up to the Sanchez place, and the answer became clear. The house directly behind Maria's parents' home was for sale. More than that, it appeared to be vacant. Maria was reserved when he picked her up from work that evening, and their conversation was desultory. It was clear that she wanted to avoid talking about Lester or Margolis. She wanted to spend the night at her parents', so he drove her home and waited outside while she packed an overnight bag. Next, he drove her to pick up her car at the tire shop, waiting until Maria was on her way before finally exiting the parking lot. He'd wanted to follow her, but thinking it would only make her more nervous, he asked her instead to text him when she reached her parents' place. 15 minutes later, she let him know that she'd arrived. Though she said nothing, he guessed she'd spent the drive to her parents' house repeatedly glancing in the rearview mirror, wondering if Lester was following her. Colin waited until after midnight to return to the neighborhood, his mind on Lester Manning. Dressed in black, he'd parked a few blocks away and approached the vacant house. In his backpack, he carried a small flashlight, a couple of screwdrivers, and a small crowbar. Still, if Lester had been inside the house multiple times, and unless he was an expert in picking locks or had a key, then Colin guessed he'd be able to get in through the same window or door that Lester had used. The entry point might still be unlocked. Unless the realtor had noticed it, there would have been no way for Lester to relock it once he'd left. Colin just had to find it. And if Lester happened to be there tonight, having realized that Maria wasn't at her condo? As much as Colin itched to exact punishment, he'd call Margolis. Maybe they could charge Lester with trespassing, maybe even breaking and entering, in addition to stalking. The street was quiet and empty. On either side of him, through gaps in the curtains of the nearby houses, he saw the occasional television flickering, but he suspected most people had turned in for the night. He reached the vacant house, and a quick check of the front door showed a lockbox on the doorknob, courtesy of the realtor. There were no partially open windows on the porch, nor any pry marks. He went around to the side of the house and noiselessly hoisted himself over the fence into the backyard. With the flashlight, he inspected the windows one by one, hunting for a small gap or pry marks. It wasn't until he reached the opposite side of the house that he found it. A bedroom window, 5 feet up, nearly but not fully closed. Pry marks on the frame, no doubt used to take off the screen. Easy for Colin to climb through, despite the distance from the ground. But for Lester? He scanned the yard and spotted an old plastic picnic table set, made for children. Based on 4 imprints of flattened, yellowing grass, the table from the set had been moved recently. Bingo. Using the screwdriver, he popped the screen off, then wedged the window open a bit farther before pushing it wide with his hands. With a quick jump and climb, he was inside. He walked through the darkened house, observing that the floor plan was similar to Maria's parents' house, with windows in the kitchen and a family room, offering an unobstructed view of the Sanchez's back porch. But the view was almost too perfect, facing both ways, and Colin knew that Lester wouldn't have wanted to be spotted, which left only one possibility. Colin traversed the short hallway, turning into the only bedroom on the rear side of the house. Unlike the ones in the kitchen and family room, the window that offered a view of the Sanchez's back porch had curtains. Turning his flashlight on, he scanned the pile carpet. Indentations near the window. Footprints. Lester Manning had been here. And there was also the chance that he might return. It wasn't until he was driving home that Colin realized he'd overlooked something important. Where had Lester parked? It struck him as unlikely that he would have parked in the driveway of the vacant house or on the street in front of someone's home. It was too noticeable, especially since many people wanted to park their own cars in front of their houses. At the same time, Lester probably wouldn't have wanted to park too far away. Turning around, Colin drove back through the neighborhood, not sure what he hoped to find, until he came upon a park that included a grassy field, a jungle gym, and benches stationed beneath oak trees. On the opposite side of the street, 10 or 12 cars were lined up. Adjacent to the park were 7 more. The lateness of the hour suggested that they belonged to the people who lived across the street, owners with multiple cars and nowhere else to park. However, another car here would be more likely to go unnoticed. Ideal for Lester. And he was sure he was right. Pulling his phone from his pocket, he snapped photos of the cars along with their license plates. He wanted to know which ones belonged. And as he did, his thoughts began to coalesce. He wanted to know what Lester looked like. He wanted to find Lester's car and license plate. He wanted to know whether Lester was staying in the area, and if so, where. Then, after that, he wanted to spend a few days watching and learning everything he could about the man. "To what end?" Evan asked, squinting at him across the kitchen table. Lily was already asleep in the bedroom.
"Margolis said that he needs proof. I'll get him proof."
"You're sure you're not doing this because you want to beat the crap out of him?"
"Yes."
"Yes, you want to beat the crap out of him, or yes, you're not going to beat the crap out of him even though you want to?"
"I don't intend to go anywhere near him."
"Good idea, because you have serious issues."
"Yes."
"And how exactly do you intend to find him? Are you just going to hang out at the park and watch for strange cars?"
"Probably."
"Because you think that Lester might one day park there again?"
"Yes."
"And how are you going to know which cars belong and don't belong?"
"Persistence."
Evan was quiet for a moment.
"I still think it would be a better idea if you just let Margolis do his job."
Colin nodded.
"Okay."
After a few hours of sleep, Colin was back in the Sanchez's neighborhood with a notebook the following day. He'd parked a few blocks away and headed to the park, exercising on a floor mat he'd brought from home while he waited. It was early,
the sun not yet up, and all the cars he'd seen a few hours earlier were still there. It was more than an hour before the first person emerged from one of the houses, hopped into a car, and drove off. Colin jotted the make, model, and color in the notebook. There was a flurry of activity at 7:30 and another flurry 45 minutes later. Two more people claimed their cars as Colin was getting ready to leave for class, leaving only a single red car, a two-door Hyundai adjacent to the park, and another two on the opposite side of the street. Probably nothing, but he nonetheless noted the information. On his way out, he detoured down the street with the vacant house. The street was empty, and he decided to risk it. Pulling over a few houses down, he headed for the house before cutting toward the fence. Peeking over, he saw that the plastic picnic table was exactly where it had been hours earlier. The window, too, appeared to be untouched. If Lester wasn't here, then the three remaining cars weren't likely his. Call it 99% certain. In class, he found himself only mildly interested in what the professors were saying and struggled to take proper notes. Instead, he wondered whether he should head to Lester Manning's last known address in Charlotte, or continue to stake out the vacant house. Or, if Maria slept at her place, whether he should watch for Lester there. All good options, but it was impossible to be in three places at once. What if he chose wrong? His mind continued to circle the problem. After leaving campus, he returned to the Sanchez's neighborhood. The red Hyundai parked adjacent to the park was still there, while the two others across the street were gone. The lonely car seemed out of place. Again, on his way out, he stopped at the vacant house and peeked over the fence. No change. Lester wasn't in the vacant house, which made sense. Neither Maria nor the family were home. He decided to stay as close as possible to Maria for the next few days. If Lester was still determined to exact his revenge, he would eventually find her, wherever she was. And wherever she planned to be, that's where Colin needed to be as well. He called and invited her to dinner. On the phone, she was a little better than she had been the day before, but still tense. He picked her up at her place after work and drove her to a bistro near the beach, where they could hear the soothing sound of the waves. Again, she avoided any talk of Lester or Margolis. Instead, she focused on her and Jill's plans for the new firm. Talking about the new venture, along with a couple of glasses of wine, was enough of a distraction to raise her spirits. Returning to Colin's place, they chatted with Evan and Lily before Maria finally reached for Colin's hand. Despite her relative calm, it had been clear to him all evening that Maria had no desire to return to her condo. Colin checked the vacant house on Wednesday morning, making sure to swing by the park and continuing to note the comings and goings of parked cars. Just as he was beginning to think that Lester had either abandoned the viewing post of the house or parked his car elsewhere, Wednesday evening brought a change in that the red Hyundai adjacent to the park was gone. Perhaps it was nothing, but it was time, he thought, to check the license plate, which ended up being a waste of time. Like the others, it belonged to one of the homeowners. On Thursday morning, Colin and Maria were having a breakfast of egg whites, oatmeal, and fruit at his place. She told him she was having dinner with Jill and Leslie and then planned to spend the night at her parents' house. "They're worried about me," she explained. But Colin knew she still wasn't ready to return to her condo alone, especially since Colin had to work. "I think they're also worried about Serena."
"Why?"
"Because I told them I've been staying with her the last few nights. We're not married, and they have old school values. I know you disapprove of lying, but I can't handle my mother's disappointment on top of everything else right now."
"I didn't say anything."
"I know, but I could hear you thinking that I should be honest with them."
He smiled. "Okay. Have you heard from Margolis?"
She shook her head. "Not yet, and I'm not sure if that's good news or bad news."
"It might be no news."
"That would fall into the bad category," she said. "He didn't exactly inspire a lot of confidence in his determination to attack the problem. For all I know, he hasn't done anything yet."
Colin nodded, acknowledging that he'd been thinking the same thing.
It wasn't what she wanted to hear, however, so he switched topics. Tomorrow's the big day.
For what?
Aren't you offering your 2 weeks' notice?
Oh, yeah, she smiled. And yes, it's tomorrow, but it's strange because I barely think about it unless I'm with Jill. It's just so surreal. A few weeks ago, I could never have imagined that I'd be getting ready to join a startup.
What do your parents think?
My mom's excited, but my dad's nervous. He knows how hard it is to start a business. He also liked telling people that I worked for Martinson, Hertzberg, and Holdman.
For now.
Yes.
She flashed a wry smile.
For now.
How's the mood at the office?
She shrugged. Hard to say. It's not as bad as it was last week, but it's still gloomy. Work is piling up, and I'm hearing whispers that more people are thinking about leaving. It's one rumor after another. Yesterday, there was a rumor that the firm was close to settling the whole thing, with all the plaintiffs, but that's probably just wishful thinking. If you read the EEOC complaints, Ken was a lot worse than even I thought he was.
Did you ever tell your parents about him?
Not a chance. If my dad had known, he would have gone berserk. Latino blood can run as hot as yours sometimes.
Then you probably did the right thing by not telling him.
Maybe. But you didn't do anything.
You're not my daughter.
She laughed. He's still not so sure about you. Because of your past, I mean.
Okay.
And also because of your present persona.
Okay.
He even has this crazy idea that you were the one who was stalking me.
Why would he think that?
Because he thinks he saw your car in the neighborhood when he was out walking the dog yesterday morning. I know he's worried about me, but sometimes he can get a little carried away.
As can I.
Chapter 20. Maria. Maria kissed Colin goodbye on his doorstep. Though he'd offered to follow her to the office as he had all week, she told him that she'd be fine and to go on and head to his classes. In the instant she'd said it, she believed it. But as she drove to work, she nonetheless found herself wondering whether Lester might be following her. For the first time since she'd moved from Charlotte, she felt her heart beginning to race for no reason whatsoever. Within seconds, it became harder to breathe and her vision began to narrow. Instinct took over and she was somehow able to pull the car to the side of the road, feeling her body suddenly go haywire. Tightness in her chest. Oh my God. This wasn't normal. She couldn't breathe. Her vision continued to narrow and her thoughts began to slip. She was having a heart attack and needed an ambulance. She was going to die on the side of the road. Her phone began to ring, but she only vaguely heard it sound half a dozen times before it went silent. It dinged a moment later. Someone texting. The muscles in her chest tightened. She couldn't get enough air. Her heart continued to pound and terror set in, feeding on the knowledge that she was going to die. She rested her head against the steering wheel, waiting for the end. But it didn't come. Instead, she simply continued to die little by little over the next few minutes, until she was no longer dying at all. In time, she was able to lift her head from the steering wheel. Her breathing eased, and her peripheral vision was returning. Her heart still pounded, but it felt less intense. A few minutes later, she began to feel better. Still shaky, but better, and though it seemed impossible, she understood that she hadn't been having a heart attack. Instead, she knew her panic attacks had returned. It was another half an hour before she felt completely normal, and by then she was already in her office. Barney wasn't around, but he'd left a new matter for her. The regional hospital was being sued by a family over an infection called Pseudomonas that had eventually led to a patient's death, along with a hastily scrawled note asking her to get started on finding the appropriate legal decisions necessary to bolster their defense. She was pondering the entry point for her research when her cell phone rang. She glanced at it, then looked closer, making sure she hadn't been mistaken. Serena? She pressed the button connecting the call.
Hey, she said, what's up? Are you okay?
Why?
I called earlier, but you didn't answer.
Serena chirped.
Sorry,
Maria said, thinking back on the panic attack.
I was in the car.
The truth, even if it wasn't the whole truth. She wondered what Colin would think about that. How goes it with the investigation?
Nothing yet.
Have you called Margolis?
If I don't hear from him today, I will.
I probably would have called already.
I'm sure.
So, what's up?
What do you mean?
You never call me this early, and why aren't you in class?
It starts in a few minutes, but I just had to tell someone.
I got an email last night, and it turns out that I'm one of the three finalists for the scholarship. I guess the dinner at Mom and Dad's must have had a positive influence. Though the email didn't exactly say it directly, I think I might actually be in the pole position.
Pole position?
Yeah, you know when they restart a race following a wreck or whatever? That's the car in the first position.
I know what it is, I'm just curious how you know what it is.
Steve watches a lot of NASCAR. He makes me watch it too.
So it's really a relationship now?
I don't know. There's this really cute guy in one of my classes. He's a little older though, and he's dating my sister, so that might be a problem.
That is a problem.
I'm just glad you put your ego aside and went to talk to him.
It had nothing to do with my ego.
Ego, close encounter to bar fight, same thing.
You're insane, do you know that?
Sometimes,
Serena admitted.
But it's worked out so far.
Maria laughed.
That's great news, she said. About the scholarship, I mean. I don't want to get too excited just yet. Don't tell Mom or Dad.
I wasn't the one who told them last time.
I know, she said. Do they still think you've been staying in the dorm with me?
Yes, and it's my turn to say don't tell them. Serena laughed.
I won't say anything, but I'm pretty sure Mom knows that you've been staying with Colin. Of course, she's operating under the don't ask, don't tell policy, which means it probably won't come up tonight.
Tonight?
Yeah, tonight.
What's tonight?
You're kidding, right? Mom's birthday? Family dinner? Don't tell me you forgot.
Oops.
Seriously? Do you never check out my posts or my tweets? I know you've got a lot going on, but how could you forget Mom's birthday?
She'd have to cancel dinner with Jill and Leslie, but they'd understand, right?
I'll be there.
Are you going to bring Colin?
He's working. Why?
Because I was wondering whether to invite Steve.
What does one have to do with the other?
It's simple. I figured that if Dad is busy glaring at Colin, he won't be able to grill Steve, and they'll think he's great in comparison. Maria scowled.
That's not funny.
Serena laughed.
It's a little funny.
I'm hanging up now.
See you tonight.
After hanging up with Serena, Maria realized she felt strangely nervous as she made her way to Jill's office. She didn't think Leslie would be offended. It was an honest mistake. Nor did she want Leslie to question Jill's recommendation. But when she said as much to Jill, her friend laughed aloud.
Are you kidding? Leslie doesn't care about that kind of stuff.
Are you sure?
Of course I'm sure. It's your mom's birthday. What are you supposed to do?
I could have remembered in the first place.
There is that,
Jill noted, and Maria grimaced. Surprising her, her cell phone rang again. Thinking it was probably Serena again, she was going to ignore it before realizing that she didn't recognize the number.
Who is it?
Jill asked.
I'm not sure,
Maria said. After debating for a few seconds, she took the call, praying to God that it wasn't Lester.
Hello?
It wasn't Lester. Thank God. She listened to the voice on the other end.
Yes, Maria finally said. I'll be there.
She disconnected the call but continued to hold the phone, thinking about it. Jill must have seen her expression.
Bad news?
Jill asked.
I'm not sure,
Maria offered, thinking it was finally time to tell her friend about her history with Lester Manning. Not to mention the drama of the past couple of weeks, including the ups and downs and ups with Colin. The thought of telling everything to Jill wouldn't have bothered her in the past, but volunteering such personal information to her future boss felt risky, even if Jill was likely to find out anyway.
Who was it?
A cop.
Detective Margolis. He asked to meet me.
The police?
What's going on?
It's kind of a long story. Jill stared at her before getting up from her desk and crossing the room.
She closed the door and turned around. "What's going on?" she said.
In the end, confiding in Jill was easier than she'd imagined it would be. Future boss or not, Jill was her friend first and foremost, and more than once, she gripped Maria's hand, clearly concerned. When Maria assured her that it wouldn't affect her ability to help with the startup, Jill merely shook her head.
"Right now, you have more important things to worry about," she said. "Leslie and I can handle whatever we still have left. You need to do whatever and take whatever time you need so that you can find a way to put this behind you for good. It's not as though we're going to have clients lining up in the first couple of months anyway. It better not take that long. I don't think I'd be able to handle it. I had a panic attack this morning."
Jill was quiet for a moment.
"I'll help you any way I can. Just tell me what you need."
Leaving Jill's office, Maria realized again that, lower salary or not, leaving to work with Jill not only had been the best option available, but already seemed to be the best career choice she'd made to that point in her life. What it didn't do, however, was help the rest of the morning pass more quickly, nor did her workload. Wondering what Margolis was going to say made it difficult to concentrate, which only prevented her from gaining traction on her research for the hospital suit. With her frustration beginning to rise, she set her work aside and texted Colin. "Yes," he texted back, "he'd meet her at the station at 12:15. She peeked at the clock. Then, back at the claim, knowing she needed to review it closely. 2 hours until she met with Margolis. Time inched by. When she pulled into the lot, Colin was waiting outside the station, wearing sunglasses, shorts, and a t-shirt. She waved as she got out of her car, hoping it would hide how nervous she was, but suspecting that Colin would know anyway. He gave her a quick kiss before pulling open the door for her. Maria felt a sense of déjà vu as she glanced around. Unlike their first visit, however, Margolis didn't keep them waiting long. They'd barely taken their seats before she saw him striding toward them from the rear of the building. Again, he was holding a file, and he used it to motion them forward.
"Come on," he said. "We'll talk where we did before."
Maria smoothed her skirt as she stood and walked beside Colin, past the others working at their desks, past the group of people collected around the coffee maker. Margolis opened the door and pointed to the same chairs they'd used before. She and Colin took their seats as Margolis moved to the far side of the table.
"Should I be worried?"
Maria blurted out.
"No. Long story short, I don't think Lester's going to be a problem."
"What does that mean?" she pressed.
Margolis tapped his pen against the folder before flicking a thumb at Colin.
"Seems you're still spending time with this particular problem child, and I don't know why you keep insisting he come with you and we discuss your case. There's no reason for him to be here."
"I want him here," she said. "And yes, we're still spending time together. Happily, I might add."
"Why?"
"I like his body, and he's fantastic in bed," she answered,
knowing it wasn't any of his business and not bothering to hide her sarcasm. Margolis smirked, but there was no humor behind it.
"Before we begin, let me set the ground rules. For starters, the fact that you're here at all is simply because I told you I'd look into your allegations, and because I told you I'd be in contact. Because your tires were slashed in addition to possible stalking violations, this is a potential criminal investigation. And in such an instance, ongoing investigations are generally not discussed. Still, because there's also the potential for a civil no-contact order, the 50C, I'm choosing to meet with you and keep you as informed as I think appropriate. Also, keep in mind that because Lester Manning has not been served a 50C, he has, like everyone else, certain and expected rights to privacy. In other words, I'll tell you what I think is important, but I won't necessarily tell you everything I know. I also want to add that most of what I've done has been via the telephone. I've had to rely on a detective friend of mine in Charlotte for a few things, and frankly, I'm not sure how much more I'm going to be able to ask of him. He's already gone out of his way, and like me, he's got cases that are higher priority. Do you understand?"
"Yes."
"Good.
he said. First, I'll walk you through the approach I took, then a bit of what I learned. Opening the folder, he pulled out his notes. My first step was to familiarize myself with all the background information, so I perused the relevant police files. That included everything having to do with the first assault on Cassie Manning, the arrest and conviction of Gerald Laws, court documents, and finally, information regarding the murder of Cassie Manning. After that, I reviewed your first stalking report, the one you made after you received the notes in Charlotte, and I spoke to the officer in charge of that particular case. It wasn't until late Tuesday evening that I felt like I had a pretty good grasp of everything. Now, with regard to Lester Manning, I'm comfortable telling you what you could probably learn on your own with a simple public record search. He glanced down again. He's 25 years old and unmarried, high school graduate. He doesn't own any real property and there are no cars registered in his name. He lists his phone number and address as the same as his father's. With that said, I'm not sure how much time he actually spends there. Maria was about to ask a question, but Margolis held up his hand to stop her. Let me finish, okay? You'll understand why I say that in just a couple of minutes. Now, I can share the next bit of information because I think it's important to the 50C, but I'm not going to go into heavy details because those may or may not be important to any future criminal case, all right? He didn't wait for an answer. Since Cassie's death, Lester has had some problems with the law. He's been arrested 4 times, but not for anything violent or dangerous. It's all minor stuff. Trespassing, vandalism, resisting arrest, things like that. It turns out that Lester has a fondness for squatting in vacant houses. In each case, the charges were eventually dropped. I haven't looked into the reasons, but in cases like these, it's usually because there was little actual damage. Beside her, Maria saw Colin shift in his seat. Other than that, I wasn't able to learn much, so I called Dr. Manning, Lester's father. I left a message, and surprising me, I got a call back within a few minutes. I identified myself and told Dr. Manning that I was hoping to speak to his son, and I will say that he was entirely cooperative and more forthcoming than I expected. Among other things, toward the end of our second conversation, he gave me permission to disclose the full nature of my call with him to you. Does that surprise you? Maria opened her mouth, then closed it again, not sure what to say.
Should I be surprised? She finally asked.
I was, Margolis said, especially given the way you described him to me. But anyway, when I asked him if he knew where I might be able to find Lester, he asked me the reason, and I told him that it was regarding a police matter. To which he responded, and I quote, "Does this have anything to do with Maria Sanchez?" Margolis let the words hang before going on. When I asked him why he brought up your name, he said that it's not the first time you accuse Lester of stalking. He said that after his daughter was murdered, you made the same accusation regarding some disturbing notes that had been sent to you. He insisted that his son Lester was not responsible then, and that he sincerely doubted that he was responsible for anything you were claiming now. He also said to tell you that while he does feel that you made a mistake by opting for the lesser charges, he's well aware that Gerald Laws was responsible for Cassie's death, and neither he nor his son blames you for what happened.
He's lying.
Margolis ignored her comment. He told me that he's not taking patients at the present time and explained that he's currently working in Tennessee for the state prison system. He said that he hasn't spoken to Lester in weeks, but that Lester has a key to the house and occasionally stays in the apartment above the garage. He said that I'd probably be able to find Lester there. When I asked him what he meant by occasionally, Dr. Manning was quiet for a beat, and when he spoke again, I got the sense that I'd touched a nerve. He told me that Lester is a bit of a nomad, and there are times when he has no idea where Lester sleeps. I think he was referring to Lester's habit of staying in vacant houses. When I pressed him, he added that he and his son are somewhat estranged these days, and for the first time he sounded almost apologetic. He reminded me that Lester was an adult and made his own decisions, and there was only so much he could do as a father. He also added that if Lester wasn't in the apartment at the house, my best bet was to try to find him at work, a place called Ajax Cleaners. It's a janitorial service with a lot of commercial clients. We didn't have the number offhand, but it was easy enough to find, and so my next step was to talk to the owner, a guy named Joe Henderson. Margolis looked up from his notes. Are you following me so far? When Maria nodded, Margolis went on. When I spoke with Mr. Henderson, he said that Lester wasn't a full-time or even a part-time employee. He worked as an on-call employee, someone who could cover shifts when they were short-staffed or whatever.
How could they call him if he doesn't have a phone?
I asked that very same question. The way it works there is they post open shifts on the employee section of their website. Henderson said it was easier to get a list of people and have them check than always scrambling to get the shifts covered. I had the sense there's quite a few people who check the list regularly. Anyway, Lester sometimes worked two or three nights a week, but in the last couple of weeks, he hasn't worked at all. Nor has Mr. Henderson heard from him. I found that interesting, so I called the house a couple of times, and no one answered. In the end, I sent my friend over there, and as far as he could tell, no one had been in the house or the apartment for at least a week. There were flyers in the mailbox, newspapers on the porch, that kind of thing. So, I reached out to Dr. Manning a second time. And this is where things get kind of interesting.
Because you couldn't reach him?
On the contrary, he said. Again, I left a message, and again, I got a call back within minutes. When I told Dr. Manning that Lester hadn't been at work, and that it didn't appear that anyone had been at the house or apartment, his surprise gave way to concern. He asked again about the police matter. I hadn't yet told him what it was, and I mentioned that I was looking into a case of slashed tires. He insisted that Lester wouldn't do such a thing. He said his son isn't violent. If anything, he's terrified of conflict of any sort. He also admitted that he hadn't been as forthcoming about Lester in the previous call as he could have been. When I asked what he meant, he told me that Lester, Margolis reached for a page in the file, suffers from a delusional disorder, more specifically, persecutory delusions of the non-bizarre type. While his son can generally function normally for extended periods, there are times when the disorder enters a more acute phase, sometimes lasting more than a month. In Lester's case, it has its roots in the occasional usage of illegal drugs. Margolis looked up. The doctor went into a bit more about the specifics of Lester's disorder. Way more than I needed to know, in fact. But essentially, it can be boiled down to this. When Lester is in an acute phase, when the disorder moves from simple paranoia to actual delusions, Lester ceases to function entirely normally. In these moments, Lester strongly believes that the police are out to get him and that they'll stop at nothing to put him in prison for the rest of his life. He's convinced they want to hurt him, and he's convinced they will set other prisoners against him. He also has the same delusions about you.
That's ridiculous! Lester's been stalking me!
I'm just telling you what the doctor told me. He also told me that Lester had been arrested a few times. It was always during an acute phase, which is why he would resist arrest. The police would generally use tasers to subdue him, and Dr. Manning added that on two separate occasions, Lester was beaten by other prisoners while he was locked up. That, by the way, goes to what I said earlier about my suspicion as to why the charges were dropped. I'm guessing that Lester wasn't coherent, and it didn't take all that long for everyone to figure it out. Margolis let out a sigh. But back to Dr. Manning. Like I told you, he sounded worried, and he said that if Lester wasn't at the house or working regularly, then he was likely in an acute phase, which also meant he'd likely be in one of two places, either hiding out in a vacant house somewhere or at Plainview, which is a psychiatric hospital. Lester's checked himself in there numerous times in the past, more frequently since his mother died. In her will, she left a trust fund large enough to cover the cost of his treatment there. It's expensive, by the way. I couldn't get any answers on the phone, so I called my friend again and asked if he could head over to Plainview in person. He did that this morning, about an hour before I called you. And sure enough, Lester Manning is currently a patient there. He admitted himself voluntarily, but that's about all the detective could really tell me.
As soon as Lester learned that a detective wanted to talk to him about Maria Sanchez, he just freaked out. My friend could hear him screaming from down the hall, and the next thing he knew, a couple of orderlies were rushing in that direction. Like I said, interesting, don't you think? Maria wasn't sure what to say. In the silence, she heard Colin's voice. When was he admitted to the hospital? She watched as Margolis's eyes shifted toward Colin. I don't know. My friend couldn't find out. Medical records are confidential, and that kind of information can't be released without the patient's permission. That clearly wasn't going to happen, at least not right then. But my friend knows what he's doing, and so we asked one of the other patients, and the guy said that he thought Lester had been there for 5 or 6 days. Of course, considering the source, you'd have to take that information with a grain of salt.
In other words, it's possible that Lester slashed the tires and left the notes.
Or he might have been in the hospital. And if he was in the hospital, then obviously it isn't Lester.
It has to be him, Maria insisted. I don't know who else it could be.
How about Mark Atkinson?
Who?
Cassie's boyfriend. Because I looked into him, too. It turns out that he may or may not be missing.
What does that mean?
I'm still doing some preliminary work on that, but here's what I can tell you. Mark Atkinson's mother filed a missing persons report on her son about a month ago. But after I talked to the detective, and right before I called you, I spoke with her to get more information, and I'm still not sure what to make of it. She told me that in August, he sent her an email saying that he'd met someone online and that he was quitting his job and going to Toronto to meet her in person. She had no idea what to make of that, but in the email, he told her not to worry. He said he'd prepaid his rent and that other bills were being paid online. The mother says she received a couple of printed letters from him saying that he was on a road trip with the woman, one of them postmarked from Michigan and another from Kentucky. But according to her, they were, and I quote, vague and strange and impersonal, and not what my son would write. Other than that, there's been no contact with him, and she insists that he's missing. She says he would have called or texted her, and the fact that he hasn't done those things means that something has happened to him. The new information left Maria's head spinning, and it was all she could do to stay seated. Even Colin seemed at a loss for words. Margolis looked from one to the other. So, that's where I am right now. If you're wondering what my plan is moving forward, I'm going to give the good doctor another call and see if he can grease the wheels and find out when Lester was admitted. Or better yet, have his son give the physicians at Plainview permission to tell me. Depending on what I learn there, I may or may not check into the Mark Atkinson thing, but frankly, that's a lot of legwork, and again, I don't know how much more time I can commit to this.
It's not Atkinson, Maria repeated. It's Lester.
If that's the case, then for now, I wouldn't worry.
Why do you say that?
Because, he said simply, as I just told you, Lester's in the hospital.
It doesn't make any sense, Maria said to Colin.
They were in the parking lot, the sun inching out from behind thin strands of clouds.
I've never met Mark Atkinson. I've never talked to him. As far as I know, I've never even seen him. Why would he be stalking me? He wasn't even dating Cassie when Laws went to jail. He didn't come into the picture until later. It doesn't make any sense.
I know.
And why the hell would Lester think I'm out to get him?
It's a delusion. She glanced away, her voice becoming quieter.
I hate this. I mean, I feel like I know even less than I did before I came here today. And now, I have no idea what I'm supposed to do, or even what I'm supposed to think about all of this.
I'm not sure what to make of it either. She shook her head.
Oh, one thing I forgot to tell you. I had to cancel with Jill and Leslie tonight because it's my mom's birthday. I'll be at my parents' place tonight while you're at work.
Do you want me to come by after my shift?
No. Dinner will be over by then. My dad makes the meal. It's the one time a year that he actually cooks, but it's not a big deal. It'll just be the four of us.
Are you going to stay there overnight or head back to your condo?
I'm thinking of going home. It's probably time, don't you think?
Colin was quiet for a moment. How about I meet you there? Just hang at your parents' and I'll call you when my shift is done.
Would you mind?
Not at all. She let out a sigh.
I'm sorry that as soon as things started clicking between us, all this had to happen. I hate that you're having to deal with it.
He kissed her. I wouldn't have it any other way.
Chapter 21. Colin. When he got home, Colin pulled the computer from his book bag and set it on the kitchen table. He was as confused about the whole situation as Maria was, and his instinct was to try to learn as much as possible. The first step was to understand the mindset of Lester Manning, or rather, persecutory delusions of the non-bizarre type. He'd wanted to ask Margolis more about it when it came up, but it wasn't his place to ask, and Maria had let it go. Fortunately, there were dozens of web pages on the topic, and he spent the next hour and a half learning as much as he could. He'd been under the impression that the disorder was similar to schizophrenia, but while certain symptoms like hallucinations and delusions were common in both types of patients, a patient was diagnosed with either schizophrenia or a delusional disorder. Schizophrenia often also included disorganized speech or delusions of the bizarre type. Bizarre meant impossible, the belief that the patient could fly or read the minds of other people, or hear voices that could control their actions. Non-bizarre delusions, the kind that Lester suffered from, were at least plausible, but untrue. In Lester's case, assuming he suffered from a delusional disorder, it made some sense that he might believe the police were out to get him. According to Avery Manning, the police had used tasers on him and put him in jail. While there, he had been beaten by other prisoners. And in the end, the charges had been dropped, which might underscore Lester's belief that he never should have gone to jail at all. His paranoia regarding Maria also made sense, Colin admitted, if plausibility was the sole criteria. Not only had Maria failed to protect Cassie, but if Lester hadn't written the notes, as Dr. Manning maintained, then Maria had sent the police after him for no reason. Not just once, but twice now. Margolis had also been right in that a person with the disorder could, as a general rule, function normally, depending on the severity of the disorder. The spectrum of delusions could run from something as simple as overvalued ideas to near psychosis. Another couple of the article stated, just as Avery Manning had told Margolis, that delusions weren't rigidly fixed. They could fluctuate in intensity and could be aggravated by the use of certain drugs. Still, as much as everything he read made sense, and while he understood that Lester truly believed his delusions, there were aspects of the disorder that didn't line up for him. If Lester was terrified of Maria, would he have delivered roses to her? Would he have sent over a drink? And if those were meant to be peace offerings of sorts, why would he have included the messages he had? Why taunt if what you wanted was to be left alone? And why come to Wilmington to do it? Wouldn't he have wanted to keep as much distance between them as he could? Initially, Colin had wondered why Margolis had bothered looking into Mark Atkinson, but Margolis was smart enough to recognize the same inconsistencies and wonder how to reconcile them. Hence, he'd called Atkinson's mother, and from there the story got even more confusing. He may or may not be missing? As vague as it was, Margolis was accurate in his description. A quick search brought up a photograph of a missing persons poster on Pinterest, no doubt created by Atkinson's mother. Other than that, there was nothing at all. He supposed he could do the same kind of search he'd done for Lester Manning, but what would be the point? According to Margolis, any information that might be helpful was inaccurate as of the date Mark Atkinson left for Toronto, or went missing. Or if not missing, was he in hiding? Colin had the sense that Margolis considered it a possibility. The timing was too coincidental for it not to be a possibility. But Maria's point was also valid. Why would he target her? According to her, she'd never even met the man. Closing the computer, Colin continued to ponder the questions before coming to the conclusion that he needed to clear his mind, and he knew only one way to do that. He ran the 6 miles to the gym and spent an hour lifting weights, finishing with half an hour of striking on the heavy bag. Without classes in session, the gym was relatively quiet.
Daly spotted him when necessary and held the bag for a few minutes, but otherwise spent most of his time in the office. He ran home, showered, and changed into his work clothes and drove to work. Behind the wheel, he pondered the same questions he had earlier. Perhaps his defensive instincts were on high alert, but for some reason, he couldn't shake the feeling that something bad was about to happen.
Chapter 22. Maria. After the meeting with Margolis, Maria headed back to the office, her head swimming with all she had learned. She stopped to visit with Jill and update her on the latest, but Jill wasn't back from lunch. It reminded Maria that she hadn't eaten, but then again, she couldn't even fathom the thought of eating. Stress. If it continued, she was going to have to buy a new wardrobe in a smaller size or have everything altered. Her clothes were already getting loose. Barney was finally back in the office, though he spent the next 3 hours behind closed doors, meeting with one paralegal after another. She assumed he was interviewing for Lynn's replacement, who couldn't come soon enough, in Maria's opinion, and though she had a few questions for him about the hospital case, she knew better than to disturb him. Instead, she started organizing her questions, making notes in the margin of the complaint, until eventually she heard a knock at her door. Glancing up, she saw Barney standing in her doorway.
"Hi, Maria. Would you mind coming to my office?" he asked.
"Oh, hey, Barney," she said, gathering her pages and placing them back in the file, feeling a surge of relief. "Thank goodness, I was hoping to talk to you about the complaint. I've been thinking that there are a few different angles we can take, and I wanted to make sure I was in the clear on what you were planning to do before I really started to dig in."
"You can leave that for now," he said. "We'll go over the case later. Will you join me? There's something we need to discuss in my office."
Despite Barney's outwardly pleasant demeanor, there was something in his tone that made her cautious as she rose from her desk. Whatever he wanted to talk about, she suddenly thought, it wasn't going to be good. Barney trailed half a step behind her, avoiding even small talk, and it wasn't until they got to his door that he reached her side. Always the gentleman, even when about to lower the boom, no doubt, he opened the door and motioned toward the high-backed chair farthest from the window that faced his desk. It wasn't until she'd moved closer to the chairs that she saw who was already seated in one of them. She came to a sudden halt. Ken. By then, Barney was already moving around his desk. She continued to stand in place even as Barney began pouring 3 glasses of water from a pitcher on his desk.
"Please," he said, urging her to take a seat. "There's nothing to worry about. We're just here for a friendly discussion."
"I should simply tell him no thank you and walk out the door," she suddenly thought. What were they going to do, fire her? And yet, the old habits began kicking in, the ones about respecting her elders and obeying the boss, and she found herself almost on autopilot as she took her seat.
"Would you like a glass?" Barney asked.
From the corner of her eye, she could see him studying her. "No, thank you," she said. She could still walk out, she told herself. But,
"I appreciate you joining us, Maria," Barney said, his drawl just a bit heavier than usual, his cadence a beat slower.
It was the same way he spoke when in the courtroom.
"And I'm sure you might be wondering why we asked you to join us. Now,
you said there was something we needed to discuss?" she interrupted. "As in the two of us?"
Barney flinched ever so slightly, his surprise at being cut off evident, but only for an instant. He smiled.
"Excuse me?
You said we, as in you and I? You didn't say that anyone else would be here."
"Of course," he said, his voice smoothing once more. "You're correct. I originally asked you to join me. My apologies for misspeaking."
He offered an opening for her to respond, no doubt expecting her to dismiss the error, but Colin probably wouldn't have said anything, so she didn't either. "I'm learning," she thought. Barney opened his hands.
"I suppose we should just get to it then, so as not to waste your time with preliminaries.
The last thing I would want is for this meeting to extend your workday.
Okay.
Inwardly, she smiled to herself. Again, it wasn't what he expected her to say, but Barney was a master of recovery. He cleared his throat.
I'm sure you've heard the rumors in the office concerning potential allegations by various employees against Ken Martinson. Allegations, by the way, that have no factual basis.
He waited, but this time she said nothing at all.
Am I correct?
He finally asked. She glanced over at Ken, then back to Barney.
I'm not sure.
You're not sure if you've heard the rumors?
Oh, I've heard the rumors, she said.
Then what aren't you sure about?
I'm not sure whether the allegations have a factual basis or not.
I can assure you, Maria, that they do not.
She waited a couple of beats.
Okay.
Colin, she thought, would be proud of her right now. More than that, she began to understand how the use of the word okay shifted the power dynamic in the room, or at the very least, set the tone she wanted, even if Barney didn't like it. He didn't, but he was professional enough to hide it, the drawl and slower cadence continuing in his courtroom rhythm.
Because Mr. Martinson is our managing director, the firm intends to vigorously contest these allegations in whatever manner the firm deems best. That includes litigation. Of course, as you know well, when reputations are at stake, cases like this are usually settled to avoid lengthy, expensive, and distracting legal proceedings. In this particular instance, any potential settlement would not reflect on the veracity of the claims, but rather the time, money, and inconvenience that contesting the charges would bring. Obviously, any settlement, if there is a settlement, would be sealed and confidential.
Maria nodded, thinking, just get to the point. Why did you ask me here?
I'm sure I don't need to review Mr. Martinson's stellar reputation with you. Those who know him best, people like you and me, know that he has always kept the best interest of the firm at the forefront of his thoughts and actions. He has made tremendous sacrifices, and it's simply not possible that he would have done anything to put either the firm or his own personal reputation at risk. The allegations, I might add, are preposterous. In his nearly three-decade career as an attorney in our community, no claims of sexual harassment have ever so much as seen the light of day in any courtroom. 3 decades of hard work, now at risk because there are people in the world who are simply greedy.
Claims that never reached the light of day because they were settled, Maria thought.
Unfortunately, whenever there's a pot of money, there are those who believe themselves to be entitled to it. In some cases, these people may lie outright. In other instances, they distort the truth with a story that fits their agenda. Other times, people simply misinterpret behavior that nearly everyone else would find inoffensive. It's my belief that a bit of all three is what's happening here, and that has led to, in colloquial terms, a feeding frenzy. Some people, these greedy sharks, now sense blood in the water and want to make sure they get their fair share because they believe it is owed them by birthright. But our fair constitution does not say that you're allowed to take someone else's property because you believe that it should have been yours all along. Greed. It's an awful, awful thing, and too many times I've seen good people hurt by it, even my own kin. My neighbors, fine church-going folk, mind you, were ruined by greedy people. But in these twilight years, I usually feel less anger than simple pity for them. Their lives are empty, and they believe they can fill that emptiness with the coins from other people's pockets. Still, Mr. Martinson's reputation is at stake, as is the good name of our firm, and I feel a responsibility, even a duty, to ensure that both Mr. Martinson and the firm received the most vigorous defense possible.
He was good, Maria thought, even when distorting the truth himself. She could understand why juries liked him.
Of course, I am certain that you feel just as strongly about integrity and maintaining the high-quality reputation of our firm. But I do have to tell you that I'm frightened, Maria. I'm frightened for the other people here, your co-workers, your friends, the young families with mortgages and heating bills, their babies and their children. I feel an obligation to them to use all the skills the good Lord has given me in the hopes that right and fair and good can prevail over wrong and greedy. But then again, I'm an old man and out of touch with the way things work these days, so what do I know?
When Barney trailed off after playing the deeply troubled card, Maria almost felt like applauding. Instead, she kept a poker face. In time, Barney sighed and went on.
I know you, Maria, and I know you share my concerns. You're too good of a person not to be scared for all your friends and co-workers here. And I know you'll want to help them because you don't desire a perversion of justice any more than I do. Our firm, all of us, need to stand united as one against these greed mongers who have deluded themselves into believing that they are entitled to your hard-earned money, even though they themselves did nothing to earn it.
He shook his head.
We just want the truth to come out, Maria. That's all. Just the simple, God's honest truth. And that's why you're here. Because I need your help.
Here it comes, Maria thought.
All we're asking of you is the same thing we're asking of all our employees. We want you to sign an affidavit that simply states the truth, that you have the greatest respect for Mr. Martinson's character, and that in your tenure at the firm, you have never witnessed or even heard about Mr. Martinson engaging in anything that could be construed in any way as sexually offensive to any employee. In your case, and for our female employees, we're also asking that they confirm that they never felt sexually harassed in any fashion at any time.
For an instant, all Maria could do was stare at him. Ken, she noticed, had sunk lower in his seat, and before she could respond, Barney went on.
Of course, you don't have to do this. In the end, whatever you choose to do is completely up to you. There is no reason whatsoever to take into account the livelihoods of anyone else in this firm. All I truly want is for you to do the right thing.
Barney finished. By then, his eyes were downcast, his body humbly positioned. Barney, a bearer of righteousness in a world he no longer understood, shouldering a burden that had to be borne by someone. No wonder he was so successful. But Maria could think of nothing to say. As persuasive as Barney was, he was lying, and he knew it. She also knew that Barney knew that she knew he was lying, which meant all of this was a game. No doubt he wanted Ken in the room as a form of punishment. Do you understand the level to which I've sunk by defending you? For his part, Ken hadn't so much as mumbled a single word. And yet, was it fair for the rest of the office, all of whom were innocent, to be penalized because of a single idiot? And how much money did the women want? Ken had harassed her, and she'd survived. In another couple of weeks, she would likely put it behind her entirely. In time, it might even become the subject of jokes. Ken was a jerk, but it wasn't as though he'd exposed himself or tried to grope Maria in the hallway when they'd been at the conference. He was too insecure, too pathetic to go that far. With her, anyway. But what about the others he'd harassed? She wasn't sure, and feeling the need to stall, she drew a deep breath.
Let me think about it.
Of course. Barney said. I appreciate your consideration, and remember, everyone at the firm, your co-workers and friends, just want you to do the right thing.
At her desk, Maria forced herself to stare at the claim that had been filed against the hospital. But every few minutes, she found herself replaying the conversation and thinking of ways she could have responded better. She found herself wondering what Colin would have done.
There you are.
Lost in thought, Maria looked up and saw Jill in the doorway.
Oh, hey. Where were you?
Jill asked.
I came by a little while ago, but you weren't in your office.
Barney wanted to talk to me, she said.
Figures, Jill said, closing the door behind her. How did the meeting with the detective go?
Maria proceeded to update Jill on the things Margolis had told her. Like Maria, Jill wasn't sure quite what to think. She asked the same questions that Maria had and was left with the same sense of confusion.
I don't know whether it's good news or bad news, Jill finally said. It's more confusing now than it was this morning.
That's not my only problem, Maria thought.
What are you thinking about now?
What do you mean?
Your expression just changed.
Just thinking back on my meeting with Barney.
And?
Ken was there. Jill nodded.
Because of the lawsuit?
Of course.
And let me guess. Barney did all the talking, and he poured on the southern charm and started talking about doing the right thing.
You know him well.
Sadly, I do.
So, did you learn anything?
They want to present a united front.
Okay.
But what exactly does that mean?
They want me to sign an affidavit that would essentially say that I never saw Ken do anything wrong, that he's always professional, and that he never harassed me.
Did Barney ask that you sign or insist that you sign?
He asked. In fact, he made it perfectly clear that he wanted it to be my decision.
That's good.
I guess.
You guess?
When Maria didn't answer, Jill looked at her.
Don't tell me there's even more, she prodded. Something you didn't tell me this morning?
Well,
let me guess. Ken has been harassing you for a while.
Maria looked up.
How did you know? Don't you remember our lunch? After you'd gone paddleboarding with Colin, when I kept asking whether things at work were going okay? I knew you'd gone to the conference with Ken, and I've been around here long enough to know exactly what he might have tried to do. Even while you were swearing that everything was fine, I had my suspicions.
Why didn't you say anything? Jill offered the kind of shrug that asked,
Do you really need me to answer that? Office politics suck. That's why Leslie and I have already outlawed them. Back then, I didn't want to put the idea in your head if it hadn't happened, but I remember thinking that I was correct in my suspicions. Which is terrible, of course, but I was kind of happy too. And I know how awful that is for a friend to say.
What do you mean you were kind of happy?
If you loved it here, you might not have been so eager to throw your lot in with us. Of course, at the time, I didn't know about the potential lawsuits.
I'm glad you're so concerned with my well-being.
You're a strong woman, Maria, and frankly, I think you're smarter than Ken. I knew you'd figure out a way to keep him at bay.
I did tell him my boyfriend, the MMA fighter, was the jealous type.
Jill laughed. Like I said, way smarter than Ken. Okay, but back to the meeting you had with Barney and Ken, our illustrious leader. So Barney asked you to sign, and you essentially told him that you'd think about it.
Maria's jaw dropped.
How could you know what I said?
Because I know Barney. He's a master at masking the obvious, showing how his side is the righteous one, and then mixing in a dollop of guilt, in case you're still wavering. It's important for you to put all that aside and think about what actually happened. And by the way, what did happen?
Maria then offered a recap of the conference, to which Jill didn't raise an eyebrow. But when she told her about the subsequent encounters, Jill went stony.
Hold on, she said.
It's one thing to offer the my wife doesn't understand me tale, but you're saying he actually touched your chest?
Well, my collarbone, or maybe just below. He didn't,
but his intent was obvious to you.
and he wanted to have lunch and discuss being more of a team player? Yes, but I stopped it from going any further. He didn't. Come with me, Jill said, reaching for the doorknob. Where are we going? To see Barney and Ken. Let's just let it go. I'm leaving anyway, and he didn't actually touch my breast or anything. Well, Barney doesn't know the details, and I'm sure that the meeting wasn't only about trying to protect the firm. It was also intended to keep you from joining the other women and filing with the EEOC. Maria shook her head. I'm not going to file. Are you sure you don't want to? Maria thought about Barney and the other employees of the firm. Ken's attentions had been awful and had caused her stress, but to her mind, simply putting it all behind her and moving on was a far more appealing option than pursuing the matter further. Yes, I'm sure. I'm leaving anyway. But don't you think Ken should be held accountable, at least a little, for all the stress he caused you? I guess, but like I said, I don't want to go to the EEOC. Jill smiled. They don't know that. What are you going to say? Exactly what should be said, and whatever you do, let me do all the talking. Don't say a word.
Before she even realized what was happening, Jill was marching toward Barney's office, Maria racing just to keep up with her. Barney's door was closed, but that didn't deter Jill in the slightest. Barney and Ken, occupying the same seats they'd been in only minutes earlier, were startled by Jill's sudden appearance.
What's going on? We're in a meeting, Barney began,
but Jill strode into the office, Maria right behind her.
Would you mind closing the door, Maria?
Jill's voice was steady and professional, but determined. Maria realized she'd never heard her like this.
Did you hear me, Jill? Barney asked.
I think you need to hear me.
We're supposed to interview another paralegal in 5 minutes.
Tell her that she is going to have to wait. You'll want to hear what I have to say. It's about the lawsuit, and it concerns both of you.
Ken remained silent, and Maria watched as he paled. Barney stared at her before finally reaching for his phone. Maria listened as he did as Jill instructed. After hanging up the phone, he stood from his seat.
Let me bring over the chair from the window, he began,
but Jill shook her head sharply.
We'll stand, she said.
If Ken didn't understand what that meant, there was no question in Maria's mind that Barney did. She saw an ever so slight lifting of his eyebrows and assumed he was doing some rapid mental calculations. Most people would likely have taken their seat again, but Barney understood the value of maintaining eye level, even if Ken did not. He stood straighter.
You said this matter concerns the firm.
Actually, I said that it concerns the both of you. But yes, in the end, it concerns the firm as well.
I'm glad you came by then, he said, the drawl and syrupy cadence returning. We just had a discussion with Maria about the false allegations, as I'm sure you're aware, and I'm confident that Maria will do what's right for all involved.
You shouldn't be quite so confident, Jill countered. I wanted you two to be the first to know that Maria just informed me that Ken Martinson has been engaging in conduct that any jury would construe as sexual.